And a very good morning to you. We're live in London. You're with Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up, Iran carries out its first direct attack on Israel, firing hundreds of drones and missiles. In the studio to give us the latest is Dimi Rader, Israeli journalist. Good morning, Dimi.
Good morning.
What's happened overnight?
So overnight we've had Israel trying to assess the damage, if any, and it seems there was very slight damage to an Air Force base. There was an injury, but nothing much beyond that.
Okay, thank you very much indeed for that. Tessa Shishkovitz and Kat Hanna are with us to bring us their views on the week's biggest stories. Tessa, I'll get your name right one day. It's Shishkovitz, isn't it? What have you spotted?
Well, we've got a lot of stories, among which is that Liz Truss felt that Boris Johnson left fleas behind in Downing Street when she moved in. So a bit of tragedy on that part also.
Thank you very much indeed for that. We'll head to France for the latest news.
Hello, this is Mary Fitzgerald, Monocle correspondent in Marseille. I'll be bringing you the news from France today, including the mood regarding the forthcoming Olympic Games.
Plus, Monocle's editorial director will be joining me from Geneva. It's the 14th of April, 2024, live from London. This is Monocle on Sunday.
Live from London, this is Monocle on Sunday with Emma Nelson.
And a very good morning to you. Let's bring in today's panellists. I'm joined by Tessa Shishkovitz. I've got it right. Author and UK correspondent for the Austrian weekly magazine Falter and Kat Hanna, urban affairs commentator. Very good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I think we better sort of press on with the events of the last 12 to 14 hours just to bring ourselves up to date. And then we shall sort of come back to the many very interesting stories you brought us this week. But let's deal with the fact that the Israeli military has confirmed that Iran launched drones from its territory towards Israel last night. Iranian state media has said the attack was in retaliation for the Israeli strike less than 2 weeks ago, which killed members of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Joining me in the studio to give us the latest is Dimi Rader, a journalist and national editor of The Lead. He's also the co-founder of the Plus 972 magazine. A very good morning to you, Dimi. Thank you so much for coming in this
morning.
Just briefly sum up what happened last night, please.
So after days and weeks of Israel anticipating an Iranian response, it finally came. And the challenge for Iran was to respond in a way that re-establishes its deterrence, but also doesn't escalate into a regional war, which is quite difficult because Netanyahu's bar for a pretext for re-retaliation, as it were, is very, very low. And what Iran did is send a highly telegraphed, highly advertised, coordinated attack that there was almost no chance that Israel wouldn't withstand. It began with a very slow wave of drones, hundreds of them, all of them were intercepted. And then it sent some cruise and ballistic missiles, all of which were either didn't make the mark or intercepted as well.
And the reports were that this was a multifaceted attack. So Iran was trying to overwhelm the Israeli defences, wasn't it, with missiles and drones coming from different directions, different speeds, but all expected to hit targets at the same time. There were launches from Lebanon and participation from the Houthis too, all of which suggest a big step up when it comes to a regional escalation.
I think it's more of a preview of what a regional escalation could look like. The attack was anticipated, advertised almost to the hour. They said we're going to hit it this weekend. They signaled via American intelligence that which areas they're going to hit and so on and so on. The risk of escalation really begins now. Now we're on knife's edge. It really depends on how Israel will respond and when, and who else will join the war if a war begins.
And we've had the United States saying, you know, there is an ironclad alliance here. There were other air forces which joined in to try to intercept these attacks, weren't there as well? So this was it was an international response.
Yeah, it was a preview also in that sense. And for some in the Israeli establishment, this is almost a dream come true. In the sense, we had France joining, we had the UK joining, we had Jordan actually stepping up actively to Israel's defense. But on the other hand, we've also had Biden call Netanyahu overnight and say, quote, "You've had a win, take the win." and say explicitly that the US will not support an Israeli counterattack in Iran.
And do you think Netanyahu will listen to that, or is Netanyahu going to go the way that Netanyahu perhaps arguably always does, which is his own way?
It's very, very difficult to tell. The rational calculus would be Israel is already really strained by the war in Gaza. It's already been operating a war on, say, a front and a half, a major front in Gaza, and a slow attrition tit for tat in the north. And this is the firepower that it had to withstand from its opponents is a fraction of what Iran can deploy. You know, today, and this is very much also about quantity, not just quality. Today, Israeli newspapers were full of reassuring headlines. Actually, this Iranian threat is not that big because the missiles are old and the drones are slow. But Israel is, as the cliche goes, a small country with not much of a home front to retreat to, with not a lot of resources of its own. The economy's already suffered. The credit rating's down. We're in the deficit ballooning, and just the population is exhausted. And it's really, the Israeli army and the Israeli state are simply not built for protracted multi-front wars.
Just tell us a little bit more about the fact that you said that Iran was using quite sophisticated weapons. By all accounts, they were quite surprisingly sophisticated. They're sort of domestically developed, launched not just from Iran, but there are reports that missiles were launched from both Iraq and from, I believe, Yemen. What does that say about sort of Iran's preparedness and the region's willingness to engage in something which could really become a regional problem?
I think Iran is certainly technically prepared, and we've seen that alongside high-density, low-quality barges, also of the kind, the kind of drones that Iran has been selling to Russia to use in Ukraine. It can also use highly, highly precise long-distance ballistic missiles. We've seen it before in the attack on Saudi oil installations. But we've also seen that despite all the multinational effort to intercept all these things, one shard of a missile seems to have hit the base that it was aiming at, which is quite impressive. And in terms of the region's preparedness, depends who we mean by the region. Iran's proxies, Likud, Hizb, and Hezbollah, are militarily prepared. I'm not sure if they have much of an appetite to actually go all in, because Iran has spent decades building up this very sophisticated proxy network, and that network probably wouldn't survive an all-out war. As to the states in the region, nobody wants an all-out regional war. So there is great reluctance on part of almost everyone.
Timmy, stay with us, and Tessa and Kat, stay with us too, because you're listening to Monocle on Sunday. We will be returning to the news that broke overnight of the Iranian direct attack on Israel. But with a time at 9 minutes past 10 in Geneva, let's just head to somewhere rather more peaceful. I'm delighted to say our editorial director, Tyler Brulé, is standing there. A very good morning to you, Tyler. How's the fountain?
Good morning, bonjour, Emma. It's just actually, I always thought of course, we're talking about this incredible, fountain, this sort of thrust of water that comes out of the harbor in Geneva. I always thought it was on 24 hours a day, but this morning woke up and actually wasn't on. It goes on at 10 o'clock, at least on a Sunday anyway. So it just started right with the top of this program.
Do you know something? I'm quite disappointed by that.
Yeah, I am too. I'm also disappointed because when I was in Geneva last year, there was a story about, I believe it might have been Australian, maybe they're American, but someone tried to sort of get on top of this fountain. Of course, they were thrown many meters into the air. They ended up in the hospital, no surprise. Anyway, none of that happened this morning.
Again, disappointed. It's a great place. But, there is still time. The day is young. Just speaking about that little bit of town, it's a very, very clever place, isn't it? Because the way that they've constructed the walkways and the way that they have built that centre of Geneva it suddenly makes it an incredibly inviting and exciting place for runners, for walkers, and for people who want to get the city done quickly and efficiently, but beautifully.
It's true. And also, this is, of course, we're in April, and there's something quite interesting about the dynamic right now, because just I was walking around yesterday evening Watches and Wonders is on in Geneva at the moment. Now, this is one of the most important, well, you say luxury industry fairs. Of course, it's focused on timepieces. And this has really taken over from Basel. Basel World used to be the fair. Basel World has disappeared as the event where the watch industry would come together, the collectors, the buyers, the manufacturers, everybody. Now, this is now taking place at the Palexpo, right beside Geneva's airport. So there's an interesting dynamic in the city right now as well, because the world is here at the moment. I say the world in terms of those retailers, the distributors, all of the luxury brands. But what's also fascinating is last night, walking around, and as you said, this incredible promenade in Geneva, it also felt like August here, because anyone who comes to Geneva, sort of July, August, this has also long been a retreat for people from the Middle East, certainly from the Gulf region. But it almost felt like that already. The weather's gorgeous here. It was probably 23, 24 degrees last night. It's going to be the same today. Absolutely cloudless skies at the moment. And you just had this sense that Kuwait, Bahrain, the UAE was all completely out of force. I'm sure, of course, part of them are collectors. They're here for Watches and Wonders. But I think also that season, the season of people leaving the Middle East, is just starting that much earlier.
And tell us a little bit, I mean, is there any reason, apart from the fact that Geneva is absolutely lovely, that Geneva is managing to steal Basel's lunch when it comes to cornering the luxury discussion?
Well, and this goes back to probably 2018, and there's always been there's long been a watch fair here. There was always a competition between Geneva and Basel, and you had, of course, a lot of the major Geneva brands going up to Basel, presenting their wares there. But there was a massive falling out in 2019, and so much so that you had the likes of Rolex and Chanel saying, we're not going to be showing, and we're not going to be showing in Basel any longer. We're going to be sort of teaming up with our friends from Richemont. There you're talking about the likes of Van Cleef and Cartier, and we're going to do our own show. So Basel has properly disappeared. It does not exist as a fair anymore. And now you have this growing fair in Geneva. And the downfall of Basel was partly just driven by not having a lid on costs. Of course, these cities, which are exhibition-focused cities, they have to be in lockstep, of course, with the hotels, with the restaurants, everybody else who is a provider of services. And it was out of control in Basel in terms of costs, et cetera. And it came to the point where a lot of these companies said, look, we're not going to be, we won't accept that you allow restaurants to charge for that 5 or 6 day period, 100 Swiss francs for a bratwurst. Forget it. You need to talk to all your other partners, and we need to make this a more palatable, literally, environment for people coming from around the world. And again, yes, maybe if you're on an expense account and you're working for a major luxury goods company, 100 francs for a bratwurst is maybe fine. But also, they have to be talking to their customers as well, or future customers is probably even more important, because yes, it becomes a little bit ridiculous. And you see this during the public days in Geneva right now. There are so many people, they may not be able to go and buy the latest watch that's come out from Tudor. You're probably not. But they are future customers, and they want to have a level of respect for them.
It was interesting. You mentioned the sort of the decline of Basel in terms of people wanting to find good value for what they're getting. I mean, as you know, I was in Zurich last week with you, and afterwards I went for a walk into the Altstadt, the old town, and I started to talk to an art dealer, and he said that they now have the Zurich Art Weekend the week before Art Basel, and that the world is coming to Zurich the week before Art Basel. They're staying in Zurich, they're commuting to Basel, and they're actually beginning to do a lot of their art business in Zurich now, because, as you say, Basel is becoming prohibitively expensive, but also Zurich is building up its own international foothold as well. And that reminds me that I need to ask you about the NZZ. The NZZ, the paper that comes out of Zurich, is doing incredibly well internationally, isn't it?
It is. I'll come back to that in a moment. Of course, all of Switzerland is expensive, and I think it is often difficult for people to, you know, square value for money. I think particularly when it comes to these major events that are hosted. But you're right. You now also have, you know, Basel is a decently connected airport. It's of course it's a hub on the Rhine. It's well connected by rail. But if you're coming, you know, from afar, you have to fly via Zurich. So Zurich has sort of said, look, well, if you're coming in from Los Angeles, you're coming in from Seoul, you're going to land in Zurich anyway. So let's treat this as an opportunity to, of course, feature the Zurich galleries and allow Zurich as a city to play host. And of course, you know, Switzerland's got great infrastructure. So I think on the fastest train, it's probably about 49 minutes between Zurich and Basel. So yeah, there's really sort of no reason that you have to book into the Trois-Rois, the Dreikönige Hotel in Basel, which of course is sort of the lead property there, unless you want to sort of have a late night, stay for a party, etc. So it is interesting that Basel becomes this platform, but it also loses out a little bit in terms of probably the revenue, that ancillary revenue that, of course, any city gets from its trade fairs. To your point about the NZZ, yeah, really interesting story. The NZZ, the German language newspaper of record in Switzerland, owned by, it has many, many shareholders. One of the interesting things, Emma, is if you're a good family in Zurich, you probably have one or two shares in the NZZ. So they always say that the NZZ annual, their AGM, is just this kind of glittering array of really the best of not just Zurich, even you could say sort of German-speaking Swiss society, that every family has, you know, two or three shares in this paper. And of course, those shares are trading for a significant amount. But interestingly enough, this is a newspaper which is incredibly dynamic as a group. So, of course, we are on the eve of Salone. We'll be covering Salone in Milan, obviously, a lot this week. I'll be heading to Milan tomorrow. One thing that NZZ has done, aside from being this daily newspaper, is they've created an incredible vertical, to use the term, and just buying up really this sort of swath of different trade publications, trade brands when it comes to design. So if you're an architect, Architonic is a very important site, because let's say Emma is designing, you know, a new building in Hong Kong and wants to specify kitchens and she wants to see the latest from a variety of companies. You go onto Architonic and pretty much every brand is represented with, of course, all of the dimensions and everything you need to know to of course, work with that potential kitchen supplier. And it's kind of fascinating to see that this is what NZZ has been sort of, you know, building up as a side business, let's say in parallel to being a daily newspaper. And as you said, they've posted some, you know, very good results for, yeah, what is a daily newspaper? A daily newspaper which has all of the trials and struggles of any newspaper around the world. But for a small country, they've been very, very clever at diversifying, and not just of diversifying in terms of other business sectors, but also language as well. So one of the stated ambitions is for the NZZ to become much more English language focused. And I should say, in full disclosure, we've sort of helped them a little bit in terms of promoting their English language edition. And they say they want to go even, you know, harder in terms of pressing their message. Paper is, I would say, center, right of center. And they're finding an audience, they're finding a currency with it, in part because, as we've sort of highlighted before, the NZZ dares to say things, and not in a provocative way, but they dare to you could say, just tell the truth, tell it like it is, like the Swiss often do, in a way that the English language press wouldn't dare to do anymore.
Tyler, very briefly, your column this week has given us a quiz.
It has. There are 10 questions in my column. As you know, Emma, probably three or four times a year, we have a bit of a call to have a competition. So yes, there is a competition, you know, literally on page, on screen. People have to respond by Wednesday. There are 10 questions that I've posed. People do not have to answer all of them. Even if you answer question 7 or question 10, you might get a prize if it's a good answer. It needs to be sharp and witty. So people have until 10 a.m. Swiss time on Wednesday to, of course, respond with their answers. And we will name those winners, not next Sunday, but two Sundays from now.
Tyler, thank you very much for giving us all some homework and for joining us on the line from Geneva. That was our editorial director, Tyler Brulé, by the fountain, by the Jet d'Eau. Just listening to that, Tessa, I mean, when you hear about the idea of the German language paper of record in Switzerland, sort of putting out its feelers into the likes of Architonic and pushing its English language, what's your response to that? I mean, having worked in both English and German language papers in Austria.
I mean, I think it's absolutely necessary to try to reach out from the German-speaking regions into English reaching. So, because English is sort of the lingua franca for everyone, so everyone more or less consumes English news. And if you want to have any relevance as a German language paper or media, you just have to try that. And you can see that, for example, Deutsche Welle also, you know, started in German, also had an English broadcasting side. And now they are basically, it's all in English, because that's how you can reach anyone in the world who is interested also in knowing what happens in Germany or in Switzerland or Austria, for that matter. The question, of course, is how much of your original content can you really, you know, how can you afford to translate? And in a time of artificial intelligence, it becomes so quickly now to click on a website and have it translated immediately by Google into English. So you can now read La Repubblica in the morning and get a certain sense of what's happening in that paper. You can do that, of course, with the German newspapers too. So it's sort of accelerating now, this move into lingua franca by artificial intelligence, and we can all sort of dip in a little bit.
And Kat, I mean, listening to the fact that Architonic is now scooped up by the NZZ, this wholly international platform, as Tyler was explaining, it's globally useful and practical. It's a very beautiful website to look at. As an urbanist, would you often think, the Swiss are going to give me all the best answers to everything I need about my next building in Hong Kong?
It's a really interesting point. And look, I think, you know, when it comes to quality of life in Switzerland, and, you know, I'm thinking about places like Geneva, I was very lucky to be there last summer. You can see that there is a lot going right, you know, in that sense, in terms of investment that's made, particularly into public realm, the quality of the environment. I think the interesting piece kind of here and the angle I'd take and thinking about some of the stories might cover on later on is it's essentially this kind of global elite, isn't it? The people who were spending that money on these very high-end kitchens, the people who were, you know, travelling to Switzerland to go and look at these watches, and actually maybe the homogenisation of that very, very top level of society. And that there are certain things shared in common, particularly in terms of taste, in terms of design and aesthetic. And obviously we're seeing certain publications then be able to reflect that in terms of what they're sharing. So geography almost becomes less important, or at least, you know, you're maybe taking some, again, the aesthetic values. But actually, again, we're maybe seeing some similarities start to occur.
It becomes a question of logistics rather than character, which sounds quite sad in certain areas, doesn't it?
A little bit. And I think, again, thinking back to the point Tessa was making again about, you know, media in different languages, I think there's an interesting question of, you know, would I rather read something that someone has written, you know, in their own language and that has then been translated through Google or AI or anything else? Or would I actually rather, you know, have a team of international journalists who are writing in a range of languages? And what actually gives me that sense of, you know, as you raised, Tessa, of what is the take? What is the sense we're getting from a particular country or region?
Dimi, I think we have to bring you in on this one. We brought you in to talk about the Iranian attacks on Israel, but actually you run an international news website. So how are you managing this? I mean, the fact that the enormous websites that we can, as Tessa said, you can read La Repubblica over your coffee and pretend that you're in Milan. Doesn't always quite work, but you know what I mean. I mean, how do you try and get a toehold in that?
Well, I mean, we try to actually be quite specific and niche. And I think on both websites, the 972 magazine that I co-founded, but I'm no longer very actively involved with, and The Lead. And in The Lead especially, we've become, we started with national content. But from January, we've been focusing on opening highly local newsletters. We have one in Blackpool, we have one in Stoke-on-Trent, Bolton, and so on. And each of them is getting a print edition of its own. So we're launching progressive-leaning local newspapers. And
dare I say it, having my dad spent a lot of time in Blackpool in the 1930s, and I spent an awful lot of time in Stoke-on-Trent as a regional reporter before the earth cooled. I think I'm wishing you absolutely the best of luck there to try to get people to engage and to pick up a paper and to really embrace what you're doing here. How do you persuade a Stokey, you know, to put down what's that wonderful thing that you eat in Stoke-on-Trent? They like pancakes, but they're not. They're oatcakes, Staffordshire oatcakes. Put down your oatcakes with bacon and actually pick up your paper.
Well, I mean, the paper themselves are getting delivered through doors, so we're kind of like
that's it. You're brilliant. Okay, so here we go. You're taking it to them.
But in terms of it's just really kind of telling the local stories. You know, regional and local press in the UK has been so decimated, and has now relied so much on aggregation and syndication that original reporting focusing entirely on one particular community is quite hard to come by. And there are people doing fantastic work. And we are actually going in there not to compete with the existing local media, but to complement. And we're doing syndication agreements with them. We're sharing content. We're doing our first hustings in Blackpool this Thursday with the candidates in Blackpool South, so the candidates to succeed the very memorable Scott Benton. And I think people just want to read about what's going on in their community. They want their community stories recognized, their identity celebrated, examined, and appreciated, and we were getting very good response.
Yeah, I think I'm just really, really welcome to hear that, and just reflecting on also this is, you know, maybe building a bit of a trend. I think anyone who's aware of the importance of regional journalism may be familiar with Jen Williams, who is now at the Financial Times, but, you know, was formerly Manchester Evening News, and I think really, you know, led the way, especially recently, in terms of driving in huge amounts of detail, looking at actually what is happening, you know, with cities, particularly as they evolve, similar work. And again, also providing that role of scrutiny, you know, actually as the politics of devolution is also changing, as the way decisions are made is changing in a lot of the regions in the UK, the importance of actually having those people on the ground that are understanding how those decisions are being taken, being able, again, to provide that level of scrutiny. If we look at, you know, places like Teesside, where there's been a huge amount of coverage there, the role there in local media is really important. And I think elevating what local media can do, you know, this isn't about, you know, very parochial stories, but actually stories that illustrate really how we're grappling with some major challenges in the UK.
It's a relevance to the audience, which is always a key part of a story that needs to be told. And when you're writing for Falta, how do you determine what pieces you submit or what your editorial desk, Tessa, is asking you for in terms of conveying what is happening in the stories that you are choosing that you know is going to be relevant to your Austrian audience?
It's a struggle. I think it was always a struggle to be a foreign correspondent, doesn't matter where you sit, to make your home office, editorial office, understand that there are things that need to be told, stories need to be told. So usually, you know, if something big happens, then everyone's alert and then you have to sort of jump on it. So during the Brexit years here in London, we were, you know, we had like 3 jobs at once to try to sort of fill the need for information in little Austria coming from here. Yeah. Now, of course, you know, I have branched out or back to the correspondence posts that I have been to before, which is Russia and Israel. So, of course, now I'm talking not about, you know, if Rishi Sunak is losing already the local elections, or if the Conservatives will be completely wiped out there, or what happens in Blackpool. But we will now this weekend report on the response that Israel is preparing to the attack of Iran.
Luckily for we have Dimi then, who can send,
yes,
who can tell Blackpool.
Gives me some information.
I think you'll be having a chat after the programme. Dimi, just briefly returning to the top story for today. I mean, the way that this is going to be covered by the international media is going to be a huge task, isn't it? Because you have the polarisation of opinion, and then you have the polarisation of various organisations which are running various media outlets, and then you have, you know, total splintering from within the region as well. It will be a really, really difficult story to tell, because the factions involved, the number of countries that could become involved in this, will make it very complicated. And the last thing a reader needs is for complication. They need to be able to get everything in the top 3 lines.
Mm. I think the right now we're actually going to see the story split into 2 lines. One will be on Iran and Israel, and there, I think it's actually going to be pretty straightforward. These are two regional powers with regional interests and risks that they might or might not want to take. And overall, I think the tone will be, let's please not do this. Let's not go to a great Middle Eastern war. The other storyline will continue to be Gaza. And this is where the polarization and the factionalism is really going to come into play. The risk in Gaza really is that the global media will develop a fatigue, and it's already developing a fatigue, but the war is still going on, and it still has so many risks, obviously most immediately for Palestinians, then for Israelis, then for the region, and then beyond. And prolongation equals escalation. If this is allowed to continue simmering onwards, we'll see more and more incidents like the one overnight.
Timmy Roeder, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. The time here in London is at 9:31 a.m. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. Joining me in the studio as well, the UK correspondent for Falter magazine, Tessa Shishkovitz, and the urban affairs commentator, Kat Hannah. We'll be talking about goodness knows what in a minute. I think it's fleas, isn't it, Tessa? But first, let's head to Marseille to hear from our correspondent there, Mary Fitzgerald. A very good morning to you, Mary. How's the weather in Marseille, I dare ask?
It's sunshiny and blue skies today. Very Marseille day.
Okay, that's enough. Tell us what's happening where you are.
Well, there's a lot of excitement on one hand, but also some trepidation here in Marseille because the Olympic flame is scheduled to arrive here in France's second city on May 8th, so just a few weeks away. And Marseille will host the sailing component of the Olympics in August. And similar to the mood in Paris, there are worries about how well prepared the city will be in the run-up, and also concerns about overcrowding, but also security risks during the events themselves. So there's quite a kind of a mixed mood here in terms of what the Olympics represent and what they may bring to the city and to France more generally. I was struck this morning, actually, the main story on the front page of La Tribune Dimanche, a relatively new French Sunday newspaper, has a survey which it commissioned. It was to carry out the survey and showed that almost 100 days before the opening ceremony of the Olympics, less than one in two French people, so 47%, feel confident about France's ability to organize the Olympics. So I think that captures quite a mood in France right now.
How French does the Olympics feel at the moment? From the outside, it feels very much like a Paris event. But I, for one, have got tickets for the football in Nice. So I know that that events are happening all over the hexagon. Is there a sense that the focus is very much on the capital, or do Marseille and Bordeaux and Nice and the like get their moment in the sun?
I think there's very much a sense that the focus is on Paris. Remember, France is an extremely centralized country, and there's always that kind of resentment of Paris, particularly here in Marseille. So I think that's kind of playing a role here. What's interesting in terms of the Olympic flame, when it arrives on May 8th here in Marseille, it will then spend more than a month, actually, traveling all around France. It will go to French overseas territories in the Pacific and Caribbean. So it seems as if the authorities here really want to kind of get a sense of people across France really joining in and engaging with this idea of the Olympics being hosted in France for the first time in a century. So the last time Paris hosted the Olympics was in 1924. And of course, the Olympics for any country, it's a huge soft power opportunity. But if it goes wrong, it's a huge soft power challenge.
Kat, you're nodding furiously. As an urbanist, you always have a very keen eye on a major event and how it affects a city.
Absolutely. And I think, thinking of our own experience in London and a bit of a personal angle for me, and that I live on the fringes of the Olympic Park, so seeing how that space has evolved. But I think what's often said is there's often two ways of thinking about hosting the events like the Olympics. And firstly is the actual period of the Olympics itself, and often the anxiety, but also, the excitement that comes with that. But then actually what happens after? So the legacy. And I think we've seen, in recent years, a much greater focus on that legacy point. So again, if you take somewhere like London, actually what happened in that summer of the Olympics was almost temporary uses, and indeed it actually was for some of the buildings. And the question is much more, well, how do you then use what many people term the kind of action-forcing deadline of the Olympics? You know, you have to get it right, or as you said, all eyes of the world are on you. How do you use that actually as a catalyst, particularly for a focus on development, regeneration, investment, for example, in infrastructure, but then thinking about the long-term benefits that can come with that?
And that's something that the French have very much thought about, isn't it, Mary, given the fact that I think there is only one, maximum two new buildings which are being constructed deliberately, purposefully for the Olympics, and the rest is all regeneration. I mean, the focus again is on Paris, but is there any sign that Marseille gets a slice of the pie?
Well, I think, first of all, in Paris, it's definitely worth noting that, you know, much of the structures basically being built for the Olympics are in Saint-Denis, so the banlieue, the suburbs of Paris, some of the most deprived parts of the country. So there is, going back to the point that was mentioned about legacy, there is a focus on legacy here. The accommodation, for example, for the athletes, that is going to be turned into social housing after the Olympics. So there is kind of a plan in terms of allowing this kind of opportunity to regenerate a part of Paris's hinterland, which has been struggling in many ways for several decades now. Here in Marseille, not so much a focus on that. There have been works on public transport, etc. But you don't get a sense. I mean, I was in Paris last week, and you know, there are huge parts of central Paris that are essentially still dug up in terms of making improvements to public transport ahead of August. You don't get that sense in Marseille, because in Marseille it's different, it's the sailing component, so it's going to be a different kind of crowd dynamic.
It's funny, isn't it? And the public perception of Marseille isn't being helped international at the moment. There's a Netflix series, isn't there, about drugs, which, I mean, frankly, is the last thing you want to start telling the world about 100 days before the Olympics.
Indeed, but it's not the first Netflix series or indeed movie to portray just this side of life in Marseille. I read a review of this new Netflix series. Well, it's been out for a few months now. In French, it's Pax Massilia, or Blood Coast, as it's the title is in the UK and the US. And there was a review in Le Monde where basically the reviewer said, can the person in charge of approving series or movie projects in Marseille, please do not accept any more proposals that give a sense that in Marseille you just have basically gangsters, drug dealers, and police officers, because this has become really a cliche of Marseille. I caught up with Pax Massilia myself last week. I will say I endured it. Wasn't a fan, I have to say. Ultra-violent and trotting out a lot of cliches about the city. That said, because I think it's really important to qualify that, Marseille has a huge challenge and a growing challenge when it comes to drug crime. Last year, 49 people were killed in drug crime-related violence in the city. And just a few weeks ago, Macron was here to launch a new anti-drug crime drive in the city. So there's a lot of concern because last year it was an unprecedented number of deaths. There's also concern because many of those deaths were basically of very young people. So we're talking about very young men, sometimes in their late teens, sometimes in their early 20s, killing each other over the drug trade in the city. So a lot of concern about it. And last month, the president of the Marseille court told senators in Paris that, in his view, Marseille had become what he called a narco-ville, a narco-city, and that he feared that the state police and justice system will lose the war, as he put it, against traffickers. So it's you know, it's one thing in terms of capturing this side of the city in movies and series, but there is a real-life reality here in the city that is worrying a lot of its inhabitants and indeed worrying Macron.
Mary Fitzgerald in Marseille, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle on Sunday. It's Emma Nelson here, joined in the studio by Tessa Shishkovitz and Kat Hannah. Tessa, let's have a look at the stories that have caught your eye, or indeed the stories that you have written this week. Tell us what you want to talk to us about.
Well, you know, it's very difficult this morning, I think, to do anything else than think about what will happen in the Middle East now. And in the Sunday Times is a story or an editorial by Matthew Syed, which I think is really bringing up a crucial point now. I mean, we sit in Europe, we watch the Middle East, and we think, oh, how will Washington try to calm the waves? And we've been so used over so many years, not so much maybe in here in the UK, but in Europe itself, on the continent, to just sort of not really engage in our own defense or also in how to pool our forces well in order to help other regions when it's need, when it needs to be done. And Matthew Syed today remembers the experiment that Max Ringelmann in the late 19th century did with his students. He was an engineer who asked his students to pull on a rope together that was attached to a dynamometer to see how much weight they could pull. And each student pulled 85 kilograms, more or less. But when they were all asked to do it together, it should have been, you know, they pulled less than weight than they should. So it was about 450 kilograms instead of 595.
So they naturally assume that someone else will pull the rope.
Exactly. So this whole idea about social loafing is something which in German we call this Trittbrettfahrer, and we need to sort of use this term in German because it's actually, especially in Austria, where we are not members of NATO, we assume that people will be taking care of our security for us. It's very nice to invest in social projects instead of defense, of course, and that's how we grew up.
That is a problem in Austria, isn't it? Because there are always perpetual questions being asked about where Austrian faith and loyalties lie, given the fact that there are still connections with Russia, which many other countries have said they don't want to have anything to do with. I mean, how do you navigate something like Austria? And indeed, if you look at neighbouring Slovakia, Slovakia has moved away from being a pro-Ukraine, pro-UK, pro-EU country with a massive change in government, which now poses an enormous problem, given the fact that both the Prime Minister and the President are pro-Putin.
Yeah, although it has to be said that Pellegrini, who was now elected President, he's sort of signalling pro-Putinist positions. But Slovakia has actually given a lot of the weapons that they could actually give already to the Ukraine. So we always have to look at the detail also a little bit here. Even Austria, who is completely you know, trying to be neutral in a moment when neutrality might be not actually called for if a country is attacked violently as the Ukraine is attacked by Russia. So these are the moments when you have to think, okay, what do we do? And I think that this very, very dangerous situation moving towards, you know, I don't want to say Third World War because it's a bit dramatic maybe, but we have to be aware of the fact that we need to really defend ourselves. And the European Union under Ursula von der Leyen at least started now pooling weapons, you know, purchasing weapons together in order to help the Ukraine, which is a big step for the neutral countries in any case, but also for countries like Germany. You know, Germany is a NATO country, has a lot of weapons industry, arms factories, that and has now to face the fact that as a strong European nation, you have to, of course, also engage on the side of the people who are being attacked and not only pretending to be, you know, very, very reluctant to get into this. And this will now play out in the Middle East also very, very strongly, because you have to sort of, you know, see that you calm conflicts, but then you have to also have some teeth to enforce it.
The interesting part, I was in Germany last week and I was in a town called Baden-Baden, which is historically described as the most Russian town in Germany. It has enormous connections. Very wealthy Russians have been over time and time again, have bought beautiful houses there, have enjoyed the luxury spa. The great opera stars go to the concert hall each year. And when Russia invaded Ukraine, the Russians went, the opera stars were kicked out and the town changed. There was a transformation again this week when I was asking hoteliers and restaurateurs, where are the Russians? And they said, well, a lot of them are back because they know that they can get out of Russia via certain ways. They know they still have their houses in Germany. They know they can still enjoy a luxury trip. The opera singers are back. But they have to go through the protests in order to get to the dressing room. But Kat, I was just the thing that got me was that it was the practicalities of how daily life operates. It is all well and good to say we need to give more of this, ostracize Russia, deal with Israel, deal with Iran, deal with whichever geopolitical crisis we're dealing with. Because at the end of the day, a restaurant still needs to run its business and towns still need to function. Communities and societies still need to function. It's really, really hard.
Absolutely. And I think there's two things here. One, it's, you know, about that reality of essentially of, you know, money talks. And especially where we have had certain towns or cities, and you're talking about, you know, quite a specific example in Baden-Baden, that the economic development has been so dependent on, you know, a relatively narrow but very important and influential, you know, cohort, and, you know, and with their own money and what they bring to that. So that in itself is incredibly difficult. I think there's also something here, and I guess taking things to more of a domestic policy focus, but actually, again, some of these similar questions, is really looking at housing. So, you know, unsurprisingly, that's the way I will.
All roads lead to housing. It's brilliant.
And then in many ways they do. And I think, but I think the reason why, actually, again, because if we're talking about, you know, how that wealth is accumulated, how it is distributed, we know we also see real estate, and we've had, you know, particularly a lot of conversations in the UK and in London about who owns some of our particularly our most expensive properties. You can see, again, there is a connection there between actually what happens in geopolitics, but actually what happens in our cities and how they are shaped as well. I think the other point, and to return to a point that Dimi made, is, and something we've heard, is, you know, no one wants a war. If you ask, you know, most people, what is it that is most concerning them? It is generally the economy, and it is the cost of living. And in many circumstances, it is, of course, you know, globally now very closely related to the affordability of housing as well. So, you know, I think seeing, you know, that there's necessarily these two distinct buckets of domestic and international, you know, is probably a little too simplistic. And I think, you know, one piece that actually particularly drew my attention was one, because it sounded like it had a very negative headline, but in some ways is actually providing some glimmers of optimism, at least in the UK, in terms of housing, which is a piece by John Elledge in the New Statesman saying the housing crisis is a problem that is inescapable. So again, in some ways, sounds pretty negative, and does highlight, obviously, the extreme, you know, consensus that we're actually now seeing emerge around the negative impact of a housing crisis, both on the economy, both on productivity, on longer term issues like pension provision, thinking about what's going to happen with demographics, but also on social inequality as well. But what he does highlight is, potentially, are we now hitting a tipping point where it is so bad, and not just so bad for a relatively small proportion of people for whom it was possible for the government to ignore, but actually for a major part of the electorate? And does that then give that window to start thinking, well, actually, maybe we do need to do something a little bit more radical here? Because if you think previously for governments, solving the housing crisis hasn't actually been particularly in their political interests. If you again think of the electorate, their age demographic, they are predominantly homeowners themselves. They welcome house prices going up. So again, if you were either an existing government or a government, you know, aspiring government, a big focus on house building or improving the private rented sector isn't really actually of that much appeal.
That stuff takes time, though. It takes 5, 10, 20, it could almost take a generation.
A long Labour government period awaits us for that.
OK, we should move on to that. OK, who wants to find, who wants to come up with another story? Kat, what would you like to bring to the party this morning? We're ranging far and wide.
We are, and I'm going to stick with the housing bit a little bit, but actually go into demographics and a bit of data. And this is a story that caught my eye, myself being a millennial, in the Financial Times.
Saying, it's your fault, isn't it?
It is.
Actually, it's the boomers' fault.
Exactly. And this is the whole thing about, I mean, I think there's always something really interesting here about how the characterization of these different, you know, demographic cohorts and generational cohorts.
Tell us, if you wouldn't mind, just mark out the millennial period and mark out what a boomer is. It's a very British word.
That's a test. Yeah, so baby boomer, I think, would be those born in around 1950s, but essentially characterized by those who benefited from economic growth, a fair amount of stability. We often in the UK think about, for example, university being more or less free. and actually, again, house prices being very affordable. So, you know, there's often this characteristic of, you know, people that were able to save for really not that long at all, put a mortgage down on a house, not completely over mortgage themselves, settle down, raise a family. And wasn't it wonderful? And a degree perhaps maybe of slight smugness that might come from that generation now.
Okay. And then the millennials.
And then the millennials, generally we're looking around kind of mid-1980s in terms of when they were born and later. Well, the people, you know, again, like myself, who kind of really came of age into the adult world in the sort of 2010s. And, you know, again, if I think of my own experience, leaving university into the aftermath of the global financial crisis, a pretty terrible labour market. But again, still the sense now and for millennials being that first generation really where you're not necessarily going to do better than your parents. And this kind of, you know, the kind of social contract that we have, that if you work, that if you save, you will be able to buy a house, secure that idea of stability, essentially not really being true anymore. So there's often then this sort of pitching you can see of the two cohorts against one another.
But this article that you want to draw our attention to is like, no, it's the millennials' fault all the way. It's your fault, Kat.
Well, not quite fault. And I think what I'd say, so it's a kind of data-driven piece by John Burns Murdoch, who does a lot of good stuff with data in the FT, essentially highlighting that, again, like a lot of people suspect, you know, being a millennial is actually, you know, and access to housing is actually as much defined by wealth and who your parents are as it does when you were born. So, you know, the phrase that, you know, that puts it simply is not all millennials were created equal. And look, I think this raises a broader point here, firstly, around look, the kind of characterization of demographic cohorts can often be quite fun. It can often, I think, have some meaning to it, but it's probably sometimes then overshadows the relative importance, obviously, of education, of class, and again, what it is that people have inherited. So the piece actually highlights, and again, I wouldn't be surprised to many people, if you have parents who are very wealthy and were able to give you a sum of money towards buying a house, you are obviously going to get increasing inequality within that group of millennials between those who had those parents who were able to help them out and those who did not.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because there's two things that I get from that. Firstly, we are obsessed with buying houses here in the United Kingdom. But secondly, we're obsessed arguably with class still. I mean, if my neighbour is a boomer, I am naturally going to be resentful of him or her because they had it good. And I'm also going to hate the millennials because they don't seem to have the same priorities as me anymore. And it's is this a particularly British problem that we have, Tessa?
Well, I think it is not the case that it's not like this everywhere else. Also, that this generation that now gets into the labour market finds that they might not have it as easy as the generation before had it during boom years. But I think, of course, this obsession with buying a house doesn't exist in that to that extent on the European continent, for example. And it's also, if you look at it from an economic point of view of is it necessary for everyone to have their own house, you know, especially if you're in urban context where you have, you know, big apartment blocks, where you have, you know, old apartments like in the big European cities, and people have very nice apartments there, and you can rent them, and it could be much cheaper for everyone involved. So, I mean, it's a question of a philosophy a little bit and a cultural tradition, but it doesn't change the fact that I think the insecurity that people feel now and that we have to take also seriously, you know, of a generation entering the labor market and finding it's much difficult because there's a huge transition, and it doesn't have to do only with house markets, but also with the question of which profession, which are still existing after AI and all this takes over a lot of our jobs.
So our houses are going and our jobs. Great. Kat, you wanted to briefly come in on that one?
Yeah, I think, again, back to this point of, you know, is this a particularly British obsession, is the focus on home ownership? And I think the answer is sort of to an extent, but actually, as the article highlights, you know, this idea that home ownership is becoming increasingly hereditary is particularly prevalent in the US as well as the UK. I think as much about philosophy and culture, though, it's also about the quality and security of the offer. And, you know, I think there's often, well, you know, we don't do, you know, the rental sector in the UK. We do, actually. Increasingly, a higher number of people do. Unfortunately, for most people, it's crap.
It's very bad. What I need to ask you, though, and I don't think anybody really is aware of the fact, is you are fully Austrian, and you are a little, you are half Austrian, aren't we? And
I am indeed.
The Austrians, so hello Austrians, Grüß Gott. How did the Austrians do it? Because everybody always looks to Vienna to get it right. But they've introduced this sort of tourist tax, haven't they? To solve a housing crisis. That if you wish to rent your house out to tourism, then it becomes rather prohibitively expensive.
Yeah, they're actually sort of limiting the Airbnb options that house owners have or apartment owners have, because they're just flooded with this tourist waves coming. But I think the main point about Vienna's housing market is that it's rent controlled. So you have, you know, nice apartments, and it's not as, you know, the Viennese, of course, complain that the rents went up now also in the crisis for 25%. But it's basically still affordable living and affordable, nice living.
So let's talk about one particular tenant of a London apartment who complained that their flat was full of fleas. I'm not talking about anybody in London. Who am I talking about, Tessie? You wanted to draw our attention to this in the final 2 minutes. We even have rental problems at the top.
That's true. And so Liz Truss wrote in her biography about her time in Downing Street 10, how awful it was. So, of course, the book must be rather short because she only stayed for 49 days. But in these 49 days, she found out that, A, it's quite noisy because there were so many protests outside on Whitehall, where you think like, maybe that was your government policy that
helped
doing this, yeah. But also, so Boris Johnson and Kerry, when they left with their dog Dylan, apparently they left some fleas behind, and that's what Liz Truss complains about.
How sympathetic are we to Liz Truss with her fleas issue? I mean, you said that rental is quote crap. But to hear that Liz Truss, I think she also complained about the fact that she just couldn't go out. If she wanted to go and do a little bit of exercise, someone had to escort her to a very nice part, private part of Hyde Park, where she could do her running and jumping in privacy. Does our heart bleed for Liz Truss, whose marvellous fiscal decisions may well have actually screwed it for any generation that's coming along, including the current one?
Yeah, I'm going to say no to that. and I think, you know, on a more serious point, you know, we have been looking at for a long time in the UK, actually, about how we can reform the private rental sector. And generally, time and time again, we've capitulated, you know, to landlords for fear that, oh, gosh, we can't do anything in case all the landlords leave the market. It doesn't appear to be happening, you know, and again, we know from a Conservative government there has been that focus because, again, given a lot of their voters, they are those people for whom owning a second home, renting it out, that's their pension. And, you know, so anything that's going to challenge that is difficult. So, you know, I think what there is definitely now a focus, particularly from the Labour Party, let's professionalise the rent sector. Let's grow it up a little bit. Let's give people the quality and the stability that they deserve.
How noble. Thank you so much to Tessa Shishkovitz, Kat Hannah, Mary Fitzgerald, Dimi Ryder and Tyler Brulé. They were my guests today on Monocle on Sunday. Thanks to the producer and studio engineer Mariella Bevan, and also to Carlotta Ribello and Laura Kramer for their assistance too. I'm Emma Nelson. Monocle on Sunday is back at the same time next week, but until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend. Goodbye. Thanks for listening.